something, and I usually tell audiences, even if you're here and you're an atheist, this is just cool stuff. It's really interesting. I usually tell them that I'm not here to prove anything, but the one guarantee I give is that when I'm done talking, you'll have a much better understanding of why so many people actually believe in creation, believe in the Genesis creation account. You'll understand better where they're coming from. What you do with the information, that's totally up to you. So that way there's no pressure. I'm not trying to twist their arms or condemn them, tell them they're wrong. I'm just giving them information they've probably not heard before. So that's kind of the approach that we're going to be using. For any of you who have heard me speak before and know my background, I apologize for a repeat of some of the slides, but since many of you don't know me from a hole in the ground, I'll go over that quickly. This is me, and that's a hole in the ground. So there are a few differences. I was raised in a Christian home, and you can see very clearly that this is a Christian home. I have a very dry sense of humor, so I apologize for that too. But Britons have a dry sense of humor, don't they? I went to our public school system all the way through high school. It's, you know, 18 years old or so. When I graduated, I went to a Christian university, John Brown University in Arkansas, to study mechanical engineering. I did get a degree, but then I became more interested in physics. So I left there and I went to the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater to get a degree in physics. And that's when my world changed quite a bit, going from a small Christian university to a large state university. Christian university, my engineering professors opened up every class in prayer. The state university, my physics professors did not open up in prayer. They were all evolutionists. I know you guys say evolutionists, and you're probably right because you guys invented it, right? It's not true. It's actually not true at all. But anyway, I'll call it evolution. So all my professors were evolutionists, and some were atheists. And they were telling me that basically everything I believed was wrong. And that made me feel very uncomfortable to be surrounded by those PhD scientists who I assumed had a lot of evidence for what they believed. But I realized for the first time in my entire life that even though I knew what I believed, I didn't know why. How did I really know that God existed? How did I know the creation account was scientifically valid? That was huge studying physics. How did I know there was a worldwide flood? How did I know Jesus was the Son of God? How did I know the Bible was the inspired Word of God? I was raised to believe every one of those things, and I did believe them. I just couldn't defend it. So God put it on my heart at that point in my life to start looking into these things. So I have been researching and lecturing for 32 years now. And a few years ago, one other thing real quickly is, the most important thing that I learned when I was studying physics is this, to never trust an atom because they make up everything. That's pretty bad, isn't it? Again, this is just a warning to have you guys beg me to stick to science and leave the humor up to the professionals. I'm also on the board of directors of a group called Logos Research Associates. It's a consortium of some of the world's leading scientists who are all committed Christians who are doing cutting-edge research or the Genesis creation account. I don't know why they asked me to be on the board, but it was quite an honor. Just a couple of highlights. Dr. John Sanford from Cornell University in New York, he founded this group. He invented something called the Gene Gun. He's worldwide famous for that. Brilliant guy. Very humble, godly man, and very, very intelligent. Then we have Dr. John Baumgartner. He's a PhD geophysicist. He's built the world's best 3D computer simulation of plate tectonics. Even secular scientists use that. It's just amazing. So, brilliant guys. This is just some of the board members, and there's a whole list of scientists who are doing all this research. So that's a little bit of my background. Again, I mentioned my wife and I, Amy. She was here 2 years ago when we were here for the first time. We just celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary last month. Our daughter Tori just turned 20. She just got engaged too. She's going to a university by our house. She'll be graduating with a 2-year degree this spring. Our son Taylor, he'll be graduating at Christmas. He's 22. He'll be graduating with a 4-year degree, 2 degrees, finance and accounting. And we were at the Grand Canyon, which I might talk about later a little bit. But Amy and I to celebrate our 25th wedding anniversary. That's a big number, so I knew I needed to do something significant. So we went to Hawaii, and we were there when the missile threat came out. This is a screenshot from my phone. So we were in the airport. This pops up into my phone and says, ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii. Seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill. The severity is extreme, extraordinary threat to life or property. I thought I'd be dead in a few minutes. There was no reason to doubt that. I thought, this is interesting. I'll probably be dead soon. And I didn't even care. Just like, so if God wants me now, that's fine. You know, I told people later, this turned out to be a false alarm. Nobody at the airport knew that. I had to text my son back in the States, you know, and he texted me saying he did some research, it's a false alarm. Like, okay. And I ended up speaking at a church out in Hawaii, too, and I told them, I said, there are some advantages to living in Wisconsin where I'm from. I said, it's more exciting to go from Wisconsin to heaven than from Hawaii to heaven. Not enough of a change, but anyway, we do live in Wisconsin. It's a real state. We love our cheese. We're the dairy state. We make a lot of cheese, and we love our Packer American football. It does get cold there. Here was a picture inside my car, minus 18 Fahrenheit, which is minus 42 Celsius. That's really cold. So you guys don't know what cold is. One day we actually got 2 feet of snow. See, you do think that's funny. It gets warm there too. This is another sign, 107 degrees, which is plus 42 Celsius. So it goes from like minus 42 to plus 42. It's not always as cold as I showed you. That's an extreme thing. It's actually a very beautiful place to live. But here's the background for this talk. I was invited to go to a bioinformatics symposium at Cornell University in New York. Bioinformatics, that's information and living things. It was by invitation only. You couldn't just show up. You had to be invited. Dr. John Sanford from Cornell University contacted me, and this was before I was on the board. I didn't really know him, but he invited me to attend the symposium. It was 27 lectures in 3 days, some of the world's leading scientists all there to talk about information and living things. So I went, took a lot of notes, put this talk together, contacted Dr. Sanford and said, if I come back out to New York, could I spend a little time with you picking your brain and making sure that my presentation is accurate? So I did that. I actually stayed at his house for 2.5 days. And he said, yes, it's accurate, and I love your PowerPoint. So I was encouraged by that. So that's the background to what you're going to be seeing here. Now, this is actually a television show in the States. It's called Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? The premise of the show is that adults come on, and they compete with, you know, children who are in fifth grade, which is probably about 10, 11 years old. So they ask them questions that these students are learning in school. And very often, the adults can't answer the questions. So that's a television show. But we're going to change this up. We're going to ask, are you smarter than a PhD scientist? Now, most people would say, well, of course not. I mean, those guys are brilliant. But I honestly believe after you hear this presentation, you will be smarter than most PhD scientists when it comes to the creation-evolution controversy. Because the vast majority of scientists don't know anything about this. They're brilliant men and women. They're not studying this. They're making better cell phones. They're making rocket fuel, food preservatives. They're doing great stuff, but this is not their area. They know nothing about it. Even the scientists who do study things that are close to this, a lot of them aren't aware of these details, and some that are don't want to talk about it. So after you hear this, which will be really easy to understand, I'm the middleman. I get to hang around these egghead guys who I think truly are brilliant, and I get to translate from English into English. Most of these guys admit they're not good speakers. That's not their gifting. So I get to listen to them and put it into a format that most people can understand. Now, we need to define our terms since we're talking about evolution here. This word is used in so many different ways. We need to be on the same page. When I'm talking about evolution here, I am not referring to things like this, how the cell phone has, or the phone has changed over the years. They actually call that the evolution of the phone. And we all know, yes, the phone has changed. But it didn't change by accident each time it was designed. But they will call that evolution. I don't have a problem with that. If they want to call that evolution, that's fine. That's just not what I'm referring to, and it's not what they're teaching in the school systems and universities. I'm also not referring to different types of dogs, or different types of cats, or even different beaks on finches that Darwin got very excited about. These are facts of science. Nobody denies those things. Everybody can see them. But those things have nothing to do with evolution as they're teaching it in the school systems. This is what I'm referring to by evolution, and this is what they teach, that supposedly 3.8 billion years ago, there was a single-celled organism that slowly evolved into every other life form on this planet, including mankind, over millions and millions and millions and millions of years. This is what they teach. I call this a story, not to be condescending or sarcastic, but to be accurate. They weren't there to see it happen. They can't reproduce it in a laboratory, and they can't test it directly. So they're telling a story about what they think happened a long time ago. We also call this molecules to man evolution. The idea that dead chemicals came together to form that living cell, which then turned into every other life form, including human beings. So I recommend people use this phrase that you say, you know, you don't believe in molecules to man evolution. If you just say you don't believe in evolution, they're going to think, how can you deny evolution? We see change all the time. What did they just do? They did what we call equivocation. They said two things equal that aren't equal, evolution and change. Yes, we see change, but evolution isn't just change. It would involve change, but it's a very specific type of change, and we don't see the type of change required by evolution. So if you just say you don't believe in evolution, they're going to think you're crazy because we see change all the time. So you might want to say you don't believe in molecules to man evolution. Now here's the premise of this talk. Certain things from a certain distance or a certain angle look pretty good, like this bright red BMW. Envision opening the, you guys call it the bonnet, call it the hood, opening the bonnet and seeing a beautiful engine in there. Well, what if when you open the bonnet, instead of seeing that, you saw this, the engine is missing. There's a bunch of wires hanging there. So what looked pretty good at first, upon closer inspection, doesn't look so good anymore. That's what we're going to see with evolution. In fact, if you look at the plausibility of evolution, certain portions of the evolutionary story do seem plausible. Just little changes here and there over millions and millions of years. It doesn't take much imagination to picture some of those things happening. For example, we have this snake and this lizard. These two creatures do not look completely different. There are a number of similarities. So it doesn't take much imagination to think that, well, maybe the snake started developing some bumps on its side. The bumps got bigger over time, and they started turning into legs, and it could crawl. Again, just little changes here and there over millions and millions of years. But when you peek under that bonnet to see what has to go on inside in the DNA, that's when you realize there's no way that this can happen. Now, Richard Dawkins, who, again, you guys are very familiar with because he lives right here in the U.S., you know, we're familiar with him too. Unfortunately, I think a lot of Christians really, you know, bash him and talk very condescendingly about him. I always tell people I like Richard. I appreciate his honesty. He's an atheist. He probably wouldn't like me. He certainly doesn't believe in the Bible or God. He would disagree with me, but I just appreciate it. He's being pretty consistent with what he believes. Or sometimes skeptics aren't quite honest with what they're really thinking. And Christians can do that too. So here's one thing that he said. You cannot be both sane and well-educated and disbelieve in evolution. The evidence is so strong that any sane, educated person has got to believe in evolution. So what's he saying? You are crazy if you reject evolution, because we all know it's a fact. Everybody believes it. It's been proven by evidence from every area of science. Nobody doubts it. One of the biggest reasons that most people believe in evolution is because they're taught that most people believe in evolution. So you don't want to be the outcast and say, oh yeah, you're right and all the scientists are wrong. So it's very intimidating, and that's why a lot of people just say, well, sure I believe in evolution. I mean, the scientists have proven it and stuff. They've got evidence. Well, Proverbs 18:17 says, the first one to plead his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him. We've all been in that position before where you hear something, and initially it sounds pretty solid. It's like, wow, you can't argue with that. Then someone else comes along and says, wait a minute, did you know about this or that or that? like, no, I didn't know those things. Okay, that first thing, that doesn't sound so good anymore. And I facetiously say that evolution 1-1 says the only one to plead his cause seems right because no one else is allowed to challenge him or present other views. This is what we have in our public or state school systems and universities. They're only presenting one view. So, of course, it's going to seem plausible, and they give you the impression this is the only game in town. If there were other options, we'd let you know, but scientifically we've studied it, and we know it's evolution. Here's a quote from Eugenie Scott from the United States. She's the executive director of the National Center for Science Education, big-time evolutionist. She said, in my opinion, using creation and evolution as topics for critical thinking exercises in primary and secondary schools is virtually guaranteed to confuse the students about evolution, may lead them to reject it. You can't give them both sides, or they might doubt the side you like and reject it. Well, you can't have that. So we're not going to teach them critical thinking skills. You don't need to think. We've done that for you. We will teach you what to think rather than how to think. So no matter who someone is, whether they are a Christian, an atheist, a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Mormon, whoever they are, their worldview has to address a number of very basic questions, and we're just going to touch a little bit on some of them. First of all is the origin of stuff, matter and energy. Where did all the stuff come from to begin with? If there's no God, how did it get here? It's part of a whole other talk that I present. After you have stuff, matter and energy, how does it form stars, galaxies, and planets? The laws of physics actually mitigate against that. I cover that in more details on a different talk. And once you have stars, galaxies, and planets, how do you get dead chemicals to come together to form a living cell on one of those planets? That's one of their biggest problems. Again, I cover that in more detail in a different talk. Once you have that single cell, how does it turn into every other life form on this planet? A great variety of life. That's what we're going to be taking a look at here, the variety of life. Specifically, how do you get that single cell to turn all the way into a human being? Well, there's a lot of arranging and storytelling that goes on when discussing evolution. As an analogy, I've got four modes of transportation up here. We could arrange these things from simpler to more complex and discuss the evolution of the motorcycle. How these small wheels on the tricycle came together to form the larger wheel here. The chains on the bike got together to make this electric scooter. The electric motor of the scooter moved forward into a gas combustion engine, and that's how we got motorcycles. That's a very silly story. No one would believe that. But all I did was I took existing things, lined them up from simpler to more complex, and I told stories. That's what often happens with teaching evolution. For example, we have the evolution of the horse from Eohippus all the way up to the modern horse. Find some fossils, line them up, and tell the stories. Here's an interesting quote from one of the leading evolutionists, Dr. Niles Eldridge. He's a former curator at the American Museum of Natural History. This is what he says about horse evolution. I admit that an awful lot has gotten into the textbooks as though it were true. For instance, the most famous example still on exhibit in the American Museum, that's his museum, is the exhibit on horse evolution. That has been presented as literal truth in textbook after textbook. Now, I think that that is lamentable, but by the time it filters down to the textbooks, we have a problem. So what's he saying? He's saying, we know it's not true, didn't happen, and it shouldn't be in the textbooks. Then why is it okay to have it in the museum? Think about the millions of students and adults filing through the museum, seeing the real bones lined up with all the plaques underneath them, telling the story along the way. And the students say, you can't doubt evolution. I've been to the museum. I've seen the bones. I read about them and how they know it's a fact. No, they read a made-up story that they didn't even admit it's not true, but the students don't know that. And even many of the teachers in the school systems, they don't know. I personally believe that most teachers and even professors are not trying to lie to anybody. They really believe evolution is true. It's the only thing they've ever heard. Then they get a degree and they go back to school to teach it. It's not like they say, we know evolution isn't true, but we're going to lie about it and say it is. No, they're convinced it's true, so I don't come down too hard on these teachers. The problem is when the leading scientists realize this isn't true, it doesn't make it down to changing museums and updating the textbooks, so it just stays in there. Here's a book of life from Stephen Jay Gould. He was one of the leading evolutionists, died in, I think, about 2002. Here's the illustration he had, talking about how fish evolved into amphibians over millions and millions of years. Okay, what did it look like in the middle? That's what we call a transitional form or a missing link. Well, they say it's not missing anymore. We found it. It's called Tiktaalik. Well, here's a problem with this. They have, since they found this fossil, they have found footprints of four-footed creatures in layers that they say are millions of years older than Tiktaalik. Well, if four-footed creatures existed for millions of years before this one showed up, he's not on his way evolving into a four-footed creature. They're already around, according to their own story and their own dating methods. That's a whole other talk, dating methods and age of the earth that I give. But so this one's really been discounted. All they did is they found this fossil. They had never seen one like that before. So they look at it and they're like, well, it's not really a fish. It's not this. We'll put it here and tell the story. It has nothing to do with evidence of one changing into another one. It's just a unique form they hadn't seen before. But talking about this isn't much different than doing this. Talking about how an Etch-a-Sketch evolved into an iPad. These two things are not completely different. There are some similarities. What did it look like in the middle? Use your imagination, maybe something like that. But you know there's no way the simple internal workings of an Etch-a-Sketch could turn itself into something like an iPad, as complex as that is. It's not going to happen. But again, that's what they're doing, lining things up and telling wonderful stories. So how do you get that single cell to turn all the way into a human being? Well, when we have children, our kids don't come out looking exactly like us. There might be some similarities, like same eye colors or hair, but they don't look exactly like us. Changes do occur. Here are the types of changes we see. We have built-in variation and random mutations. The built-in variation has to do with the genes in our DNA. We've studied it, and we have a pretty good idea how it works. We know what to expect. The random mutations, those are accidental copying errors. When creatures reproduce, they copy their DNA. And there's so much information on the DNA that mistakes are made. Since they're random, we don't know what to expect. So we will look at each of these one at a time, starting out looking at built-in variation. We have two dogs up here. These dogs have medium-length fur. They actually each have two copies of genes that make medium-length fur. Why do they have two copies? Because they had a mom and a dad. The mom gave them one copy, the dad gave them the other copy. So they have two copies. Because they're medium-length fur, they've got one gene that can make long fur and one gene that can make short fur. In their bodies, as they were developing, these two genes actually combined together, and it gave them medium-length fur. When they breed together, they will each pass on one of those genes. They don't get to pick or choose, just one goes or the other. If they both pass on a gene for short fur, the puppy comes out with two copies that both make short fur. It doesn't matter which gene is used or if they combine. That's going to have short fur. If they both pass on a gene for long fur, the puppy's going to come out with long fur. If one passes on a gene for long fur, the other for short, the puppies can come out with long fur or short fur, or they could combine to give it medium-length fur. So genes give us a variety of fur length. But they don't just do fur length. They do other things, too, giving us big dogs, small dogs, long ears, short ears, all the different features we see on dogs. Precoded in the genes. Not a surprise. Okay? If you look at these two sets of animals, A or B, which set looks more similar to each other? Pretty obvious. The animals in set A look more like each other because they are really the same kind of animal. Genesis says 10 times in 5 different verses that God created creatures to reproduce after their kind. Can they produce a nice variety? Yes, they can, but always within limits. In fact, today, dogs, dingoes, coyotes, and wolves can all breed together. But scientists call these different species. generally they say a species is a group of animals that can't breed with other groups of animals. But here we have these different species breeding together because they're really the same kind of animal. In fact, when you breed a dog and a wolf, you get a wolf dog. It's not a surprise. It looks a little bit like the dog, a little bit like the wolf. It's real science. It's what we would expect. But you can't breed the dog and the wolf and get an ostrich. That one's not going to happen because it doesn't have genes to make beaks and feathers. There are some other animals you can breed together. You can breed a zebra and a donkey, and you get a zonkey. It does really sound funny, but it's actually real science. Why? Are these two completely different animals? No. Basically, the same type of animal, it's just that this one has a nice paint job. You can also breed a lion and a tiger, and you get a liger. Why? Well, because these are both large cats. But you can't breed a lion and a kangaroo to get a lion-garoo. That one's not going to happen. Because they're not the same kind of animal. There are some other animals you could also not breed. It would be these here. That's what happens when you have Photoshop software and too much time on your hands. Of which I have neither. I didn't do these, but they're kind of funny. But we laugh at this because it can't happen. And genetically, it can't. And we don't expect it to. And the Bible doesn't predict that. But we do see similar kinds being able to breed together. So that was the built-in variation. Now we're going to look at the random mutation. Here's a quote from the University of Berkeley in California. They're very, very strong on evolution. It says, mutations are essential to evolution. They are the raw material of genetic variation. Without mutation, evolution could not occur. Very, very important for evolution here. They go on to say, mutations can be beneficial, neutral, or harmful for the organism. There's an awful lot I could say, especially about the supposedly beneficial mutations. Cover that in Q&A if you want. But I got to keep moving here. We have error correction going on in the DNA. When the DNA copies itself, you know, these mistakes happen. A lot of mistakes. Well, life wouldn't be possible if we couldn't correct the mistakes. And there's at least a three-tiered system that's designed to correct these errors. If the first layer misses it, second one kicks in. If the second one misses it, the third one kicks in. If somehow it makes it all the way through, that is a true mutation that gets passed on then. The interesting thing is, we've got more details of the problem. It says on a good day, about 1 million bases in the DNA in a human cell are damaged. If you picture this ladder on here, these rungs going across the ladder, those are the bases. So on a good day, 1 million of these rungs are damaged in the cells throughout your body. Fortunately, the correction system corrects almost all of those. And, you know, the cells in your finger don't get passed on to your kids. It's just related to your current health then. But all that damage is going on every day, but then it corrects all that, most of that. And so what's interesting is we've got the chicken and the egg dilemma. You know, the whole scenario here, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Which came first, DNA or the error correction system that makes it survive? Interesting thing about that is guess how the error correction system is developed? By using instructions in the DNA. But how can you have DNA without the error system? But you can't have the error system unless you have DNA that codes for it. So it's a huge, huge problem of how that whole thing came about. But here's how evolution supposedly works. When I give this presentation at different places, I say we are now magically transformed into a state university. And I'm now going to be a PhD biology professor to teach you how evolution works. This is what they say. We've got a single-celled organism here that's going to reproduce itself. So it has to copy its DNA. And it does that, and it has children. And you can see the children look very much like the parents because it's a copy of the same DNA. Then the children reproduce, and we have grandchildren, which look pretty much like the parents and the grandparents. Because, again, it's a copy of the same information. You would expect it to be very, very similar. And that's what we see. Then the grandchildren reproduce, and, oh, we've got problems. Some significant mutations are happening. Some, they say, are bad. Some, apparently, are good. The natural selection comes along like a superhero and wipes out the bad mutations and keeps the good ones. Then the process continues. The new guys, they continue to reproduce them. Now we have more of the new ones. The original ones continue to reproduce. We have more of the original ones. And this process continues on for millions and millions and millions of years. Can you imagine the great variety of life we would have on this planet through this process? Now, I guarantee you, the non-Christian students sitting in this classroom say, that makes perfect sense to me. You can see it for yourself. And this is my PhD biology professor. He knows what he's talking about. This is proof. You can't deny that. But I guarantee you, most of the Christian students would have the same conclusion. Makes sense to them, too. Maybe the Bible didn't get it right. Maybe Genesis is wrong. Maybe it has some errors in it. Maybe it wasn't meant to be taken seriously or whatever. So they trust this, but now they start doubting Genesis. And it's a slippery slope. They keep throwing more and more out. That's a different talk here. But this does seem to make sense on the surface. There was a famous radio announcer in the United States, died a number of years ago. His name was Paul Harvey. He was famous for telling us the rest of the story. It was a brilliant show. He would tell you something that you were a little bit familiar with, and then he would go into details you never knew. And he says, now you know the rest of the story. It was just always fascinating. So we are now going to look at the rest of the story regarding these mutations. Can they do what the scientists tell us they do? They make things better and better and better. So I'm going to make three major points about mutations. First of all, that they are randomless, purpose, and undirected. They occur in the DNA, and they're almost entirely detrimental or bad. We'll look at each of these one at a time. First of all, that they're entirely random, purposeless, and undirected. Here's a quote from Nova Online. This is an evolutionary source. It says, it's sometimes convenient when trying to make sense of evolution to think of changes within a species as having a purpose, as though Mother Nature has some intended goal that she sets out to achieve. The bacteria want to survive, someone might reason when thinking about the declining effects of antibiotics, and so they evolve into resistant strains. Of course, there is no purpose in evolution, just random mutations within DNA, most of which are detrimental to the survivability of the organism. Those are the three points that I just made on the previous slide, and this is from an evolutionary source. But here's an interesting quote from Discovery News magazine talking about dinosaurs. It says, presumably the sauropods evolved large body size as a strategy to deter predators. What are they saying? This is what they're implying. That apparently at some point in the distant past, dinosaurs were not as large as they eventually came to be. So they're sitting around the campfire one night and they're saying, hey, you guys, we need to come up with a strategy to deter our predators, or we're going to go extinct much sooner than we're supposed to. Do you have any ideas? And they say, no, our brains are too small. And then one of them says, I have an idea. What if we got some machine guns out? We could shoot our predators. The first dinosaur says, no, we can't do that. They haven't been invented yet. So it's okay, good point. Second dinosaur says, I got an idea. What if we hopped onto our motorcycles? We could ride off into the sunset. First dinosaur says, no, we can't do that either. They haven't been invented yet. Okay, good point. Third dinosaur says, I've got an idea. What if, just what if we evolve really large body size? We could scare them away. First dinosaur says, no, that's a good idea. Are we all in agreement? Okay, break. And they go off and they get big. I don't know a scientist on the planet who believes that. The leading evolutionists do not believe that. They don't think that a creature needed something or strategized to get something and then it went off and did it. But very often the popular literature like this will give you the impression that these creatures needed this to survive, so they evolved it. But they know it doesn't happen that way. But you'll have other examples of the fish. Millions of years ago, were swimming around in the oceans and food was becoming scarce. So they had to evolve lungs to crawl up onto land to find new sources of food. And the students write that down. Makes sense. They had to do something or they're going to die. So they evolved lungs. Think about this. So we have lost, especially the youth, have lost our critical thinking skills. How did the fish even know what lungs were? I know they swim around in schools, but they wouldn't know what lungs are. How do they know what oxygen is up there above? They don't even know what's above the water or land or anything. And even if they knew what was up there and what lungs were, what are they going to do about it? All they have is DNA that makes fish parts. And even if they could somehow try to make some small changes here and there, what do they do when they're halfway there? And they can't breathe underwater anymore, but they're not cutting it on land yet. They can't survive. But the students don't think about it. They don't have time. They're busy. I just have to write this down and memorize it to pass the test, to pass the class, to get a degree, to get a job. And what do I care? I don't care if evolution's true, even if they're a Christian. Well, God used evolution, move on. You know, you don't take Genesis seriously, but I still believe the Jesus stuff. Well, when they do that, it doesn't take long, and they throw out the Jesus stuff too, for many reasons. So, moving on here. That was the first point very quickly. The second one, even quicker. These mutations are occurring in the DNA. So let's take a look at DNA. DNA is like a very, 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 very complex blueprint with lots and lots and lots and lots of information on it. So we will look quickly at the storage capacity of DNA. So let's say you had just a teaspoon amount of DNA and you wanted to back it up on CDs. How many CDs would you need? A single CD can hold 100,000 pages of text. That's a lot of information on one CD. So now you're going to back up just a teaspoon amount of DNA. How many do you need? You'd need 100 CDs, but that's actually not true. You would need 1,000 CDs. That's not true. You would need 1 million CDs, and that's only partially true. You would need 1 million CDs given to you every minute for 9.5 years, and then you'd have enough CDs to back up just a teaspoon amount of your own DNA. But you know what? That just happened by accident. That's what nature does. That's what we teach. And the students buy into it. They just write it down and move on. That's crazy. But moving on here. DNA, the coiled up ladder, you're familiar with what it looks like. It's like a giant set of encyclopedias. And the rungs on this ladder are equivalent to single letters. A single rung is like one letter out of that whole set of encyclopedias. It's what we call a nucleotide, or these rungs. When you group a bunch of those rungs together, that's how you make words. So you put a bunch of rungs together, you have words. When you put thousands or tens of thousands of these rungs or nucleotides together, that's how you make a gene, which is like a single chapter in one of the volumes out of the whole set of encyclopedias. Then when you put thousands of genes or chapters together, you get a chromosome, which is like a single volume out of that whole set of encyclopedias. Then when you look at the entire set of encyclopedias, that's what we call the genome. For people, we call it the human genome. You've all heard the term before. That's just a little bit of basic biology 101. I wonder how much longer I can do this because youth, you know, encyclopedias, what are those? We're getting away from all that, so I have to probably update my talk. The third point, this is where it's most interesting. So if you've been bored out of your skull so far, this will start to pick up. These mutations are almost entirely detrimental or bad. So let's look at that. And again, this is how the story of evolution goes. Let's say that the amount of information found in a single cell bacteria is about the amount of information you would find in a biochemistry textbook. That's a lot of information. And that's about how much information is in a single cell. But remember, we have to change that cell all the way into a human being. So we have to make a lot of changes. So for our analogy, we're going to look at this book, Biological Information, New Perspectives. This is a book that was generated from the Bioinformatics Symposium I mentioned at the beginning. All the authors put their papers together, produce this book. We're just going to look at a sample page out of this book. On the right, circle some text, put the text on the left here then. Now, we can't just copy this text. If we just copy this text over and over and over, millions of years from now, we will have a lot of these books identical. They'll be the same if we're just copying them. If we want to change this information, we've got to change the text. What are the changes? Well, we've been talking about them. They're the mutations, these random copying errors. That's what scientists say drives evolution. You make random changes to DNA, and it gets better and better. That's their story. Well, let's take a look at some example mutations here. First of all, we have a duplication mutation. I take the word level, and I put an extra L in there. It doesn't spell level anymore. Oh, if you were reading this, you would say, oh, that's just a typo. It's a mistake. You know, it's level, and you'd move on. It's not how our DNA works. Our DNA would read that and say, I've never seen this before. It's meaningless. I would skip it. You just destroyed that piece of information. Then you have a deletion mutation. We'll take the M out of the word model. It doesn't spell model anymore. Then you have a substitution mutation. We'll take, it's hard to see, take the P out of probability and put a Z in here. It doesn't spell probability anymore. These are samples of real mutations. This is what really happens when creatures or people reproduce, copy their DNA, these mistakes happen. What's interesting is you could think about maybe someone who's 8 years old. You could find them and ask them, hey, what's your favorite book? And they tell you the name of some book. You say, okay, if we were to take your book, close our eyes, open it up randomly, stick our fingers in there, whatever letter we touch, we delete it. And we close our eyes again, open up randomly, touch somewhere else, whatever letter we touch, we take that letter out and put a different one in there. Then we open up again, touch a letter, and we just make a copy of that same letter. We just keep doing that to your book day after day. What will happen to your book? Will your book get better and better and better? An 8-year-old child will tell you no. It'll get worse and worse. In fact, I won't even be able to read it anymore. An 8-year-old child understands that. You have to be highly educated to not get this. And that's what happens with these PhD scientists. They are plenty smart. But they either don't know about this or don't want to know about this because they don't want creation to be true. They don't want the Bible to be true. They want to be able to explain everything on their own so they're not under God's thumb to obey His rules. But this is so simple. But the challenge for evolution gets worse than everything I've mentioned so far, and this is now where we get into the information that I got from the bioinformatics symposium, a relatively cutting-edge information that will show you there's no way that evolution's possible. And it has to do with information structure. How is the information actually written on the DNA? And this is super easy to understand. It won't be over anybody's head at all. So, first thing, let's say that you were looking at your DNA. Just lost. It's either down here or on the other end. But unless, I think the power went out altogether. That's what happened. There we go. Now. There we go. Just stay out. It'll take a minute to warm back up again. So again, what we're going to be doing when we get the slide up, we're going to look at how information is written on the DNA to determine can you make random changes to it to make it better, better. The first example we'll look at, we'll see in just a second. I want you to see the visuals before I get any further. So I don't even see the light here yet, but do you know how long it takes for it to come on?
Well, it's just about
minutes
and
off minutes. Oh, okay. Oh, there. Now I saw a flash.
Okay.
I can tell one other quick joke. So we were talking about relationships and marriage. This was from a counseling video series that my wife and I saw. It was very, very well done. But the counselor, he was actually a pastor. He's talking about this couple that was having a heated argument back and forth and back and forth, and the wife was getting very frustrated. She finally said to her husband, you know, you always tell me that you would die for me, but you never do. Yeah. That's pretty harsh.
Excuse me. Like a very good English.
Ah, no, it's come back up.
Okay. So we'll look at the information structure here. So let's say that you were looking at a segment of your DNA and it spelled out, was it a rat I saw? Kind of a strange phrase. In English, we read from left to right. But you may have already noticed that you can read this backwards. Was it a rat I saw? It's called a palindrome. Forwards and backwards. This is what we've discovered, that much of our DNA can not only be read forwards, but it can also be read backwards. But the challenge for evolution gets worse than that, because that was the same message, forwards and backwards. So you take a look at this here, the word desserts. If you flip that around, it spells stressed, which is what I get when I don't get desserts. So let's introduce a random mutation, which again, mutations are supposed to be, you know, really driving evolution. Random mutation here, we'll just delete that T. It no longer spells desserts. But it also doesn't spell stressed now. One random change messed up two messages because it goes forwards and backwards. But we don't see little words in our DNA that flip back and forth like this analogy. We see up to entire chapters of complex instructions that can be read both forwards and backwards. Let me give you an analogy just for this to sink in how amazing this is. Let's say you have a job working in a cell phone factory. Your boss comes to you one day and says, I have a project for you. I need you to write the chapter in the manual that explains how the phone is going to download apps from the web. And you say, yeah, I can do that. He's walking away, then he turns around and goes, oh, I'm sorry. I forgot one minor detail. When you write that chapter, you have to write it in such a way that if we read it backwards, it will explain how the phone's going to play music files. You would be looking at your boss like, you're kidding, right? You're just being funny. He says, no, I'm sorry, we only have so much room in the manual that has to be read forwards and backwards. That is humanly impossible. It cannot be done. You cannot even program a computer to produce that. I did computer programming for 18 years. It can't be done. But that's what we're seeing in our DNA. We read it one direction. It's a set of very complex instructions that make specific proteins that carry out a certain function in your body. You read it backwards, it's a completely different set of instructions that make different proteins that carry out a different function in your body. And there are two major points with this. Number one, particles smashing together in nature, which is what evolution is. There's no God designing things and creating things. It's just particles interacting over time. They will never produce a complex information system that can be read forwards and backwards. Secondly, you can't make random changes to that system and make it better and better. You're going to make it worse and worse. But the challenge for evolution gets worse than that. We have overlapping information in our DNA. Take a look at this phrase here. I like chocolate later that evening. Kind of strange because it's two phrases. I like chocolate, which is true. And later that evening. Overlaps in the middle, those four letters it shares. This is what we've discovered, that we have overlapping messages in our DNA. Let's introduce a random mutation. Again, we will just randomly take out the E and put a Z in there. It doesn't spell I like chocolate, and it doesn't spell later that evening. One random change messed up two messages because they overlap. But we don't see just a few letters that overlap in our DNA. We see up to entire chapters that overlap each other. But the challenge for evolution gets worse than that. We have spliced information in our DNA. Take a look at that same phrase again, I like chocolate later that evening. Let's underline a few segments and then bring them down below, and it spells, I like her hat. This is a spliced message. Let's introduce random mutation here. We'll randomly just delete the H. It doesn't spell I like chocolate, but now it doesn't spell I like her hat. One random change messed up two messages because they're spliced. This is what we see in our DNA. It's called alternative splicing. But we don't see just a few letters like that that are spliced. We see up to entire long sentences and short paragraphs that are spliced. So Here's the analogy. Picture you're looking at the biochemistry textbook. You read it from cover to cover. You just learned a lot of information. Now you go back and just take random long sentences and short paragraphs from different places, put them together, and now you have another chapter of complex instructions. It's impossible, but that's what we're seeing in our DNA. But the challenge for evolution gets worse than that. We have embedded messages in our DNA. Take a look at this sentence here. Can you show Mike Owen checks from Oliver's latest fax and set it on the desk? Strange sentence. Let's circle every eighth letter. And then bring those down below, and it spells chocolate. There's a theme going on here. It's my talk. I can do that. Let's introduce one of our random mutations. We'll just randomly delete the H. It messes up that main sentence when you're reading it. But it also messes up the embedded message, because now all the eighth letters after that are going to be shifted over one spot, because we took one letter out, so it shifts everything over. So now the eighth letters are those. Bring those down below, and it's completely meaningless. So one random change messed up the main message in the sentence, and then it also messed up the embedded message. And this is what we're seeing in our DNA. There's actually embedded messages there. And guess what? The challenge gets worse than that. We have encrypted messages in our DNA. I actually had two interviews with the CIA in the United States, Central Intelligence Agency, to work in their cryptographic analysis division. Interesting story for some other time. It was actually kind of creepy, too, of all the things that it would have involved. So anyway, getting back to the talk here, let's take a look at this phrase here across the screen. Seems completely meaningless. But what if you found out there was an encryption key? Meaning everywhere there's an H, it's really an A. Everywhere there's a B, it's really a C. Everywhere there's a Y, it's really a T. So that's a T, and that's a T. If we make all those substitutions, you see it spells this as an encrypted message. That's one way of doing data encryption. And this is what we're seeing in our DNA. We got the regular message, and then we have encrypted messages. So let's take a second to think through what would be required to create an encrypted message system, keeping in mind there is no God, no creator, no designer. This is just nature doing its stuff, because that's what they teach. Okay, what's required? Well, first of all, you need to develop a language system using symbols. So let's say you have three sticks like that, and you put them together this way, and you say that's going to be an A. And then when you have three shapes like this and put them together that way, we're going to call that a B. You have to create an entire alphabet by particles smashing together in nature. Second step, you have to create and define words. When we put these four letters together, it's going to represent that object. You have to create an entire dictionary of words and definitions by particles smashing together in nature. Then you have to write meaningful sentences and paragraphs, which requires rules of grammar. How do particles smashing together in nature create rules of grammar? Then you have to establish the encryption system with that key we talked about. After that, you have to create the system that does the coding and the decoding. And then you have to develop the ability to read and carry out these instructions, or the whole thing is meaningless. There is not a scientist on the planet who can even begin to explain how particles smashing together in nature created these things. Again, most of them don't even think about this. This is a huge challenge. And just one last time, the challenge for evolution gets worse than that. I'm skipping a few details. You can thank me for that later. We have 3D information in our DNA. This is a little bit harder to depict with PowerPoint, but I'll do my best here. When DNA makes proteins that carry out the functions in your body, they're not these little ladder things. They get folded into very, very complex three-dimensional shapes, like a lock and key. If they don't get folded just right, they are useless. And they are usually deconstructed, and their components are reused. So let's put 7 random words up on the screen here, and we are now going to fold these And the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to stack them on top of each other. And when we do it this way, you'll notice that going up and down, there's an additional piece of information on the word success. Well, obviously, if you introduce a random mutation by deleting letters, changing letters, duplicating letters, you're going to mess that up. But also, if you don't fold it right, if you don't stack them right, you also lose that piece of information. So we actually have 3D information going on in the DNA. I'll skip some of the details, but it's just another level of complexity. And when you're making random changes, you're messing with this as well. So the conclusion, even though certain things look pretty good, like the bright red BMW, we envision opening that bonnet and seeing that beautiful engine, we just opened the bonnet of evolution to find out the engine is truly missing. There's nothing there to make evolution work. Here's a quote from a geneticist from Poland. It said, genetics has no proofs for evolution. It has trouble explaining it. The closer one looks at the evidence for evolution, the less one finds of substance. In fact, the theory keeps on postulating evidence and failing to find it, moves on to other postulates, fossil missing links, natural selection of improved forms, positive mutations, etc. This is not science. One last quote you may have heard before. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's what the Bible has said for over 2,500 years. And as I tell people, even though this is God's first shot at writing a book, I think he did a pretty good job. We can trust it from cover to cover. And the more we look at science, the more it backs up what God has been telling us all along. We'll do a little bit of Q&A. I'm probably going to skip most of the slides that I have. These are just general slides anytime I'm traveling around and giving talks. We have some free live stream broadcasts. We started doing it last May. The way that works is you can go right to our website and see these for free. The next one's going to be kind of strange when I was putting this on here. I first put February 22nd, and then I realized, no, it's going to be February 23rd for you. We do it in the evening, so it's actually at 1:30 in the morning and 3:30 in the morning. All you have to do is go to thestartingpointproject.com. That's our website. You don't have to install any software. You don't have to sign up for anything. You just pull up the website. You'll see me speaking for maybe 25 minutes, and then we do Q&A. And you can actually, from the website, type in a question and hit a button, and we get it instantly, and then do questions. We also save the recordings of these on our website, so you can go on your own time and watch them. And unless you can't sleep at night, then you could always get up and watch the live broadcast. But you can also go to that same website and then see all the archive of the old ones. That's a free resource. These are the resources I have over sitting on the table. There are 9 different DVDs. This is our email newsletter. That's free. You can, again, go to our website, thestartingpointproject.com. Sign up for the newsletter there. I did put the forms out over here. Otherwise, you could fill out a form, but that's a free resource. We have DVDs that are sitting over there. The one that has a picture of a DNA on the outside, that's the identical talk that you just heard. All the PowerPoint, it's basically me in a TV studio giving this talk with the PowerPoint on a flat panel monitor. So it's all the PowerPoint illustrations and everything, keeping it very simple. We have the book that I wrote. I've been told by some of the world's leading scientists they think it's the best overview that's out there, which I was honored and humbled to hear. And then I wrote 7 pocket-sized booklets. A lot of this information in the booklets is actually in the book. I'll skip most of this. We don't charge anything for our engagements. I've been speaking 32 years, have never charged a penny. The main way our ministry exists and that I can support my family is we have monthly donors, and when people sign up to be donors, we give them a free set of our resources, but I'll skip the details on that. I told you that our events are free. We don't charge for the events. We do ask that travel expenses be covered. This was kind of an exception for the Truth for Youth Conference. They don't pay our airfare. We pay for it. But then if we have enough engagements, it hopefully brings in a little bit of income with donations or sales or whatever. So it's a little bit different. But normally in the States, you know, churches or conferences just, they get me to the place, put me in a hotel, but there's never any charge for the event. So if you know of other places, in fact, very specifically, I know Truth for Youth wants me to come back in August. They already have this August planned. Next August, they wanted me to come back, but our daughter's getting married that very weekend, so that's not going to work. So they said, how about 2020? Which I said, fine, but that's 2.5 years from now. So I will probably be back then. That's a long time. But they also mentioned it might be possible for me to come back to do a speaking tour independent of Truth for Youth, maybe while school is in, so I can also go up and speak at the New Tribes Bible Institute College, because when Truth for Youth is on, their school's out, so I can't speak there. But Tim mentioned if I was back some other time, I could speak there. And if we find other churches in the area, it could even be over in the Netherlands or Germany or Wales or anywhere. If I have enough events, I could come back virtually anytime. It would be nice to do it during the summer. Been here twice now in February. I've seen enough rain. Here's something you guys should really do when you have a chance. I'm serious. If you go to Google, look up the word sun, S-U-N. It's fascinating. There's this huge yellow thing in the sky. It's bright, it's warm, and we have it over in the United States. You know,
we have forgotten what it looks like.
Yes. So, but it would be nice. My wife would come with me. But that's a possibility, to come back and do some more talks, whether it's at a college, a university, school, churches, conferences. I would think between everyone that I'm reaching while I'm here, if they start making connections, we could do a tour. So that's another possibility. And again, there's never any charge for the talks. It just helps if, you know, I'm not expecting someone to pay all of our airfare, but if we could figure something out, that would help. We've got these forms. I didn't put these forms to fill out, but you can stay in touch with me. Grab one of my business cards. It has our email on there and our website. This is actually a picture of the Chuck Missler's conference. For those of you who know Chuck Missler, the Strategic Perspectives Conference, when I was speaking there, I was just there in October. So anyway, free events if you're interested. You know, stay in touch with us. You can help us schedule a tour. I mentioned the Grand Canyon earlier on. I co-lead tours. I normally have some other slides on this that are kind of funny, but I'll skip the humor. If you're ever interested in, how many of you ever seen the Grand Canyon? None of you? Okay. It is fascinating. It's a little bit like going to Israel, in the sense that anyone who goes to Israel says, once you've been there, you'll never look at the Bible the same again. Everything just comes so alive, and you're so excited about reading this. It's kind of like that with the Grand Canyon. When you go there, and we give lectures on scientific evidences for the worldwide flood of Genesis 6 through 8, it's not just about looking at a big hole in the ground. It is cool to see, but we give these lectures saying the Bible is accurate. There really was a global flood of Noah. Here are the scientific evidences, and we show that. We spend one day walking along the rim, looking 1 mile down to the Colorado River. I'm actually afraid of heights, but I figured it wouldn't be an issue because the canyon's not high. It is really deep. And then the second day, we are actually on the river here. We go through this famous horseshoe bend. It's just beautiful. Now we're looking up at all the layers. And we give lectures along the way, mini lectures, simple, showing you evidences you can see for yourself that there's no way that that river carved out that canyon over millions of years. It had to be catastrophic burial of all these layers during the flood. And at the end of the flood or shortly after, them being washed out catastrophically, as they're still fairly soft. It's just very powerful. So when they say you go to Israel, you'll never look at the Bible the same again. I wanted to tell that to a group once, and I said, if you go to the Grand Canyon, you will never look at the Bible again. I said, no, that's not what I meant. You'll never look at the same again. But it's a very powerful trip. It's very easy trip, too. It's not climbing on rocks. It's not walking uphill. It is a flat, paved path that you walk on. And then we take a bus down to the river. And you get off the bus, and you get into a raft, a very large raft, and it's smooth sailing. They rate the Colorado River for its rapids from 1 to 10. The rapids we go through, 0.1. Just little trickles in the water. So you're not falling out of the raft or anything. And we stay in really nice hotels. You're not camping out in tents or anything. We had a couple go. They were 80 years old. They loved it. And we had younger children go. So it's very family oriented. It's basically 2 days. This is 4-day span. One day you're traveling to Phoenix, Arizona. The last day you're traveling away from Phoenix. 2 days in between, we spend 1 day on the rim, 1 day on the river. So if anyone's interested, we still have a few seats left for this coming June 28th. We'll probably do it again next year if anyone's interested. But some, we've had 4 people. After I was here 2 years ago, we had 4 people sign up and come over and go on the trip, and they just loved it. So that's a lot of fun. So with that, we'll do just a little bit of Q&A. You can ask questions about what I presented or anything else. Anything about creation, evolution, the Bible, the flood, dinosaur, I mean, anything. Just ask it loud enough for me to hear. I give lectures on the human ear and how hearing works, and then I went and lost a lot of my hearing. So so I'm not going to give lectures on the human eye because I don't want to lose my sight. But, just ask whatever question you want. I'll make sure that everyone else also heard it, and I'll try to be relatively brief in answering it so we can get to as many questions in just a few minutes. And then I'll obviously be here afterwards if you want to casually ask additional questions.
Yeah, I've got a question. I'm working in Peterborough, and there's a little girl with a disorder called Reich syndrome, or severe autism. And when I asked what it was all about, so I was a bit suspicious of vaccinations, I was told the genes mutate about a year old, and it's a sort of mutation which causes this, and no one else in the family would necessarily have got it, which they haven't. And I just don't know, from what you say, I still don't understand genes can mutate. Is that possible?
Yes. The question about autism and that it's caused by mutations in the gene, yes, the genes, when the DNA is copied, there are mutations or mistakes that happen all the time. Sometimes those errors are caught, say, hey, wait a minute, this is wrong, I'm fixing that. Other times those mistakes get copied and passed on. In fact, every time we as humans, every time we reproduce, we take all the mistakes we currently have. It's called the genetic load, all the mistakes we currently have that have built up to this point. When we reproduce, we take all those mistakes, we copy them, we copy the good stuff and mistakes, and then we add another 100 new mistakes and pass them on. So my parents had a bunch of mistakes in their DNA. When they had me, they copied all those existing mistakes and then added another 100 and hid them to me. Then when my wife and I had our 2 kids, we copied all the current mistakes we had and added another 100 and gave it to our kids, and they didn't even thank us. So these mistakes keep accumulating, which caused one Russian scientist to ask, why are we not dead 100 times over? Meaning if we've been evolving from an ape-like creature for 6 million years, which is what they believe, how can we still survive? These mutations are accumulating and we can't stop it. Natural selection does not clean up all those mistakes. It can't get rid of them primarily because the evolutionists will say, okay, yes, you're right. Mutations are largely bad and there are a lot of them. However, they're only slightly bad. That's true, and that's also a problem. Here's why. Let's say you buy a brand new car, driving down the road, and at some point, one molecule somewhere underneath oxidizes and turns to rust. Is it a bad thing? Yes, but it's only slightly bad. One molecule, you don't even know it. You don't even see it. Then later, another molecule turns to rust. Is it bad? Yes, just slightly bad. You don't even see it. And then another one. Pretty soon, you can start to see that your car is starting to rust. And eventually, your car falls apart. So that's what happens in our bodies. These mutations, most of them are only slightly bad, meaning it doesn't stop the creature from reproducing. So it takes those mistakes and copies them and sends them along. The next creature takes all those and adds more of them and sends them along because it doesn't stop them from reproducing. That's why they're accumulating. So with something like autism, that's a very significant mutation. You notice that right away. It affects the mind. These children don't develop the way that they should because of a very significant mutation. If the mutations are too significant that actually kill the individual, that's really bad, but now they're done. They won't pass on that bad information to anyone else. They're just done. So in a sense, the really, really bad ones, those aren't an issue because it stops those genetics from moving forward. The dangerous ones are the ones that are slightly bad because they keep getting passed on. So autism is an example of a mutation that's very significant, and it really affects human life. Other mutations might make one earlobe a little shorter than the other one. You might not even notice. You don't care. It doesn't affect your life. Was it a mutation? Yes. Is it a slightly negative thing? Maybe, but it doesn't matter. Other mutations might cause something where it does affect you a little bit, but you could still live a life or whatever. You might be born without arms. That's definitely negative, but you could survive. It's unfortunate, but people survive. So those are pretty significant mutations, but the dangerous ones are the small ones that keep getting copied and accumulate, and eventually they do cause massive problems because there's too many of them. And so mutations are real. We can't stop them. And they go against the idea of evolution because they're going downhill. And if we've been around for millions of years, there should be so many mutations we can't even function. On the other hand, if we were created by God, and it's a whole other talk, if we were created by God in six literal days, roughly 6,000 years ago, the curse and the sin caused the curse and death to come into God's creation. And so now bad things are happening, including mutations occurring and getting worse and worse. But we can still survive because we're not that old. If we lived another million years, yeah, we would see a lot of issues because they would really start to accumulate. But God knew what he was doing. He knew how long we were going to be here, and he knew we could handle a certain amount of mutations. So it's not an issue, but we do see more and more and more health problems. Sometimes we're clever, and we come up with medications and things to help, but there are more and more and more diseases to tackle. I've seen it even in our own family. I hadn't thought about it, but my son really got into running when he was in his teens. But shortly after that, his legs would start to hurt. He's like, I don't think I can keep running. My shins hurt and my knees a little bit. And he was very frustrated. He liked running. And then he thought, well, maybe he'll get into weightlifting because I do a lot of weightlifting myself. So he started doing that. And then he started having pain in his elbow. He couldn't do much. So he had to give that up. He's very fit and healthy, but he's like, Dad, what's going on? You get to do all these things and lift really heavy weights. Here I am. I'm young. I'm fit. And I got all these issues. And I said, well, it's really these mutations. They're accumulating more and more, and his own children and grandchildren will probably have even more issues. And we can only last so long doing that. So I don't think that Jesus is going to return a million years from now. I don't think that would be possible, physically speaking, for many reasons. He'll probably return relatively soon, and then that's okay. We can survive. We might have some health issues. That's another reason that God limited our ages. The Old Testament, you know, people living... Now, Adam, 950 years, or 930 years, Noah, 950 years, Methuselah, 969 years. And God says, no more, I'm not going to let that happen. Look at all the trouble you guys get into when you're living that long. He shortens our ages after the flood, and it's a good thing, too, because with all of these issues now, with these mutations and our health getting worse and worse, just think of health issues you may have right now, and you might be 60, 65, 70, 75, 80. Do you want to live to be 600 or 900 having these many issues already? No. God is smart. He knows that. He's limited our ages. And so a lot of that fits into the biblical timeline and chronology, but it totally causes problems for evolution.
Scientists talk about using artificial intelligence and genetic engineering to try and compensate degrading genetics.
Yeah. Are scientists messing with our genes to try to fix some of that? They certainly are. And on the surface, that makes sense. If they can go in there and change things genetically, even in the embryo, to try to avert some bad things happening later, on one hand, it makes sense. If they can do that, go ahead. There's really nothing immediately terribly wrong with that. The problem is they don't know what other issues it's going to cause. Just like when we do hybrids of plants and genetic modifications of corn or other plants, there might be some benefits to that, but there might be some terrible negatives to that. We just don't know yet. We haven't been around long enough to see, is the genetically modified corn we're eating, is that going to cause problems later? It very well could. So we need to be very careful with what they're doing. It's not a black and white issue. It's, you know, kind of a gray area. Same thing with cloning. Can they clone plants that might be of a benefit for some reason? Yeah, they can. I don't have a problem with them doing that. they're careful and we kind of keep watch what they're doing. What about cloning animals? There might be some benefits there to do some experiments to see if we could come up with some solutions for humans. What about cloning human beings? I would say probably not, because now we're tampering with life that was created in the image of God. And the problem with cloning is you go through a lot of examples to finally get one that seems to work. So you're killing life forms along the way. When you do that with human beings, you are killing life forms along the way before you get one that seems okay. I'm not aware that they're doing human cloning, but I can't imagine that they're not. I'm sure they're doing it behind closed doors, because the world isn't ready to hear that they're cloning human beings, but they have to be working on it. The problem is, they go through all those versions, killing life forms, and they finally get one like, hey, this works. What happens if it goes bad when it's 8 months old, 3 years old, 18 years old? Is it really human? Does it have a soul? Who owns it? Whoever created it, can they get rid of it? Because, yeah, it went bad, it's mine, I'm going to get rid of it. That would be bizarre. Who determines that it's truly bad? They might say, whoa, this clone here thinks that Jesus Christ is the only way to heaven. We know that's wrong. We're getting rid of this one. That could happen. So that's a whole can of worms, talking about that subject.
They cloned Dolly in the
yes.
1990-something. But I saw in a film in the 1970s, Boys from Brazil, it explains exactly the same technique. So just looking at films, they knew how to clone 20 years before we heard about it.
Yeah, they probably had the cloning technology for a long time. They finally got around to where it looked nice for the public. I mean, if they were creating monsters prior to that, they wouldn't want the public to see that. They're probably practicing for a long time, and they finally got this cute little sheep. They clone it, and it's a clone that isn't that so cute. The public is okay with that. But if they were producing these monster-looking things with legs coming out where the eyes should be, saying, what are you doing? So, yes, they probably were trying it since the 70s or whatever. Today, actually starting maybe 4 years ago, they were trying to clone a woolly mammoth. Wait a minute, how does that work? The Jurassic Park movies, they were cloning dinosaurs. Because the story goes, they found some amber that was millions of years old and it had trapped some mosquitoes that had bitten some dinosaurs, and somehow you got dinosaur DNA in there that they brought back, and then they used that to clone it, and they were producing the dinosaurs. That's the story behind the movie. Very entertaining idea. Not actually scientific, because the only way you can clone an animal is to find some preserved DNA from one of those creatures and then put it into the cell of an egg from a living creature. So like a living, you'd have to not only find ancient dinosaur DNA, you'd have to have a living dinosaur, a female to lay an egg, to go into the nucleus, the center of that cell, take out its DNA and put in this other DNA and let that develop, that would be a clone. Well, we don't have a living dinosaur to lay that egg. So how do they clone a mammoth? This is how. They've got mammoth carcasses that have been preserved in the ice, and they found the DNA. It's still preserved. It's probably somewhat degraded, but it's still there. Okay, well, we don't have a living mammoth to lay an egg to put it in there. We don't. What they're doing is they're taking an egg from an Indian elephant. Because if you think about it, picture an Indian elephant, an African elephant, a mammoth, a mastodon, they look very similar, just like pictures I have. They're the same kind of animal. So they're taking the DNA from the woolly mammoth carcass, putting it into the egg of an Indian elephant to see if they can get it developed. I don't think they've made a whole lot of progress yet. They haven't been talking about it. One creationist I know, who's a biologist, he says he doesn't think it's possible. It's so complex. But I guarantee you, if they are successful, the very first thing they will claim is, this is proof of evolution. It's not at all. You're taking existing information, putting it together, and showing how two similar kinds of animals can breed. We already have that with dogs, dingoes, coyotes, and wolves. But the public will buy it and say, well, now you really have to believe in evolution because we have a living woolly mammoth. It would be a hybrid of an Indian elephant and a mammoth. I think it'd be kind of cool. But they will use it to support the idea of evolution.
I mean, I think the interesting thing that's come out of this talk is that anybody of average intelligence can see that evolution is a total impossibility, and you've only really tackled one aspect of it. So why don't people believe it? And I think the Bible tells us
it does.
That our fight is not against man, but principalities and powers. That however much information you or anybody can throw at atheists, they're still atheists. They won't evolve into Christians.
Sure. Sure. That's the most important point that I can make. I'm glad you brought that up, because you might be thinking, okay, this is very straightforward. Seems very simple. How could anyone argue with this? Well, most people really couldn't argue with that. In fact, every time I've given this talk, and we've had some skeptics in the audience, none of them have ever commented on the content of my talk. They always bring something else up. And we can talk about that, but they can never address this. But Romans chapter 1 explains why, even with this evidence, they don't believe. Because it's not an academic issue, it's a spiritual issue. And I've actually talked to atheists, and I told them, I said, I'm a Christian, and I believe that the Bible is the inspired word of God, so I want to share some with you. And they instantly said, no, don't give me that Bible stuff, I don't even believe in the Bible. And I say, oh, I totally get that. You're an atheist, you don't even believe in God. You certainly don't think that the Bible is His word. That's okay. I still want to share it with you because I want you to accurately understand what it claims for itself, as opposed to having an opinion about it based on what someone else told you about it. Most skeptics have an opinion about the Bible based not on their own research, based on someone else telling them. It's filled with errors and contradictions. Science has disproved the creation cult. There never was a flood. There's different versions out there, and there's missing things in here, extra stuff that got put in here, and on and on and on. So the atheist says, oh, yeah, I don't believe that. That's garbage. But they haven't looked at it themselves. So I say, I know you don't accept this. That's fine. I just want to share what it says so you will accurately know what it's claiming for itself. What you do with that, that's up to you. I said, with that, you know, I tell them that I am a Christian, so I do believe this from cover to cover, and I don't have a choice. I can't say, well, I believe this part, but not this. I like that, but I don't like this. If I do that, I become the ultimate source of authority in my life, and that's dangerous. And then I can't really be a Christian, because God says this whole thing is His word. So, okay, so if I'm a Christian, I really have to go by everything it says. And the atheist gets that logic. Again, they don't believe the Bible, but he understands where I'm coming from. I have to live in a box. Whatever the Bible says, I have to go with. Otherwise, I don't really believe the Bible, and I can't call myself a Christian. So I said, because I believe this, I have a choice. I can either psychoanalyze you to figure out where you're coming from, to how to approach you, to see what arguments are going to work. Or I could say, okay, God, did you tell me anything in here about skeptics? And it does. It says a lot about the skeptic. So I tell the atheist, when I am talking to you, I have to go by what God is telling me about people in your position. And it happens to tell me in Romans chapter 1 that God has given so much evidence for His existence just in nature itself that people are without excuse. It goes on to say, not only has He given them evidence, but He's actually placed it in their heart that He exists, that they are without excuse. So I have to believe. You're telling me you're an atheist, you don't believe in God. That's fine. But I have to believe you know God exists. Now, it goes on in that same chapter to say that many of those skeptics out there who God has given this evidence to and told them that He exists, many of them have chosen to reject it and not believe it, not because of their superior intellect, but because of their own unrighteousness, their sinful nature. That's why they reject it. And it says, professing themselves to be wise, they have become fools. Romans 1:22. That is not name-calling by God. He's not saying, oh, they're fools. He's describing their thinking process. Because they have decided to reject all the evidence He's given them, He gives them over to a reprobate mind, darkened thinking, professing themselves to be wise, they have become foolish in their thinking. So when we run around just throwing DNA evidence at them and they say, I don't think that's evidence for God, and we say, how can you not see this? Romans 1 tells us why they don't see it. It's a spiritual issue. So I actually tell the atheist, this is not an academic issue. If you want to hear about the DNA, that's fine, I'll tell you, but I don't expect that that's going to change your mind. This is a spiritual issue, and until you are willing to submit your will, the will God has given you, until you're willing to submit that to God, your Creator, we're not going anywhere. It's up to you, whatever you want to do, but that is the approach I have to take with you. Otherwise, I don't believe the Bible. So I want them to know they have a sinful nature and they have been fighting God. Many times they know that inside and it upsets them and they get more angry. Sometimes they've been fighting God so long, they're numb. And they really don't think that God exists and they don't even buy into what I'm saying because they've pushed God away so long. But I still need to share the truth with them because they are accountable. Just one other thing very quickly. God never says, if you can tell people about DNA or carbon-14 dating or whatever, that's going to get to them. Sometimes when we share those things, God graciously uses that to challenge their thinking. But there's no guarantee there. What God does do is he guarantees us that anytime we are actually sharing his word, it's guaranteed to not return void. It's Isaiah 55:11. His word will never return void. It will always accomplish his will. This is how I believe that works. When you actually share the words of God, it will either be used to convict and convert the person, which is what God would like. He's not going to force it. Or it will be used to condemn them. They heard the word and they rejected it. And it's not your responsibility or mine to force which outcome happens. It's just up to us to share it. And the Holy Spirit does the convicting in their lives. And they can make their decision. But we are responsible for sharing it with them. So I tell them that too. I'm just going to tell you this. Do whatever you want with it. But the Bible also says in Philippians chapter 2, one day every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. He's given you an opportunity right now to use the will he gave you to say, okay, you know what, maybe I don't know everything. I'm not going to do it my own way. Maybe God knows better, and submit yourself to God. Or once you're dead, you will still acknowledge that he's Lord, but now it's too late to make that decision. But he's given you that time now. So think about that. Do you want to gamble with your life and take your chances? Or do you want to say, maybe you don't know everything. Maybe there is a God and maybe he's got a better plan. If you want to do things differently, you don't like God's rules, that's fine. But then you might want to create your own universe because this is his. He created it. He gets to set the rules. So anyway.
Brad. One more question.
One more.
Yeah, hey, Brad. My grand and I were speaking to a man earlier. We were talking to him about the flood going up above the peaks of the mountains and depositing fossils on some of the mountains. He said that that was the tectonic plates that shifted, brought the mountains up, and that's why the fossils were there. How would you answer that?
Sure. Just briefly talking about the flood, and there's so many things we could say. I gotta say two things. I'll get right back to that question. But this is even more important. This would have been part of the beginning of the other talk I would have given. A lot of people don't think much about the flood. They're just like, yeah, it's another story in the Old Testament. You know, we don't know what to think about it. We don't focus on it much. We don't worry about trying to think through the details. When you look at 2 Peter chapter 3, which is written, you know, roughly, let's just say 2,000 years ago, Peter, 2 Peter 3, is talking about the end times. We probably all believe we're probably living in the end times. So Peter, 2,000 years ago, is telling us what's going to happen in the end times. And he's specifically talking about skeptics, those who are denying the return of Christ. Peter says that these skeptics are willing, King James says, willingly ignorant of two things. They're ignoring two things that are causing them to doubt the return of Christ. Well, the return of Christ, that's a very strong spiritual thing. So the two things that they're ignoring are probably spiritual things as well that are causing the doubt the return of Christ. Nope. Not what he says. Peter says the two reasons why skeptics of our day are going to reject the return of Christ are, number one, they are rejecting the original creation account, the Genesis creation account, that God created everything by water through water, he covered the earth with water. It was a miraculous creation. They're rejecting that. And number two, they're rejecting the flood, the fact that God used those same waters to flood the earth as judgment because of sin. Today, those are the two number one things that all secular scientists reject. They certainly reject the Genesis creation account, but they also don't believe in Noah's flood. Unfortunately, many Christians also reject the Genesis creation account. They say, well, it says that, but it's just poetry. It's just God was just kind of giving us the impression that he's the creator. But he never meant that he actually did it the way it's described there. And the flood, no, that didn't really happen. Where did all that water come from? Where did all that water go? How did Noah get all those animals on that ark? And on and on. So that's just a story. You know, Jesus told stories, so that's a story in there to teach us about, whatever. But it didn't actually happen. Christians do that. The flood is critical because it relates to creation, it relates to God's judgment. If you're rejecting God's judgment because of sin, then you're going to reject his final judgment, where Peter goes on to say that he's going to judge again, but not with water, this time with fire. There's so much more buried in that chapter. Getting back to answering Brad's question, we do have fossils of sea creatures on top of Mount Everest, 5.5 miles high. How in the world did that get there? Well, secular scientists know that there are sea creatures fossilized on mountaintops. So they envision that these layers were lower down in the past and there were calm oceans that were sitting over the land and things were settling out, forming the layers and fossilizing. And then the layers were pushed up and then they were lowered again for oceans to cover, make more layers. And then they're pushed up again slowly over millions of years. And then they lower down again for the next layer, and then push up, and all these things, crazy stories. If that happened, up and down, and up and down, and up and down, these layers that we're looking at, some of which they say happened hundreds of millions of years ago, and then they were all pushed up, and then back down for the next layer. If you push solid rock layers up like that, they're going to be shattering and bending and all that. We don't see the shattering in these layers. Sometimes we see some bends. Sometimes even here on the south coast here, these great hairpin turns, 90-degree turns in solid rock. But there's no shattering in these layers. They could not have been laid down slowly over millions of years. They must have been laid out catastrophically during the flood. And as they were still soft, the plates in the earth are moving and folding these layers up, and then they harden after that. So these layers in the earth could never have been pushed up and down and up and down, because we should see evidence of all that movement, shattering, and many other things. We don't see that. So how is it that those fossils got up there? It's not that like there was Mount Everest existing in the original creation, and a flood came and water somehow went 5.5 miles up there to cover up Mount Everest. No, the Bible says in Psalm 104 that at the end of the flood, God caused the mountains to rise, meaning whatever mountains we had weren't quite as high, but now they're being catastrophically pushed up out of the waters. So when they're lower, they are covered with water. And sea creatures that are washed in from the sea across on top of the continents are now, being laid down in those layers catastrophically. And the only way you get a fossil is to bury something rapidly. You can't slowly accumulate these layers and fossilize things, because the creatures would rot away before they're buried. So the ocean waters are coming catastrophically onto the continents, burying all these creatures rapidly, making multiple layers, and then at the end of the flood, God caused the plate movements to push the mountains up, Psalm 104, and the valleys or trenches to go down deeper and deeper. Mariana Trench, 6.8 miles deep. God did that for a reason, to set a boundary so that the waters of the earth would never return to flood the earth. There's still as much water around. Now the mountains are too high and the trenches are too deep. God did that to promise us it's not going to happen again. So we believe those layers were laid down when the mountains were not as high. Fossils were being created there with those layers, and then they were pushed up. That's why we have fossils of sea creatures on top of Mount Everest and all across the continent. In fact, 95% of all the fossils we see are sea creatures, marine invertebrates that don't have a backbone, because they're the ones who are living in the oceans, and that water was thrown up upon to the land. And then the small portion that remains, I won't go through all the details, it's rare that you find a fossil of a bear or a monkey or a rat or a human being, because those types of creatures were very mobile. And as the floodwaters are coming, they're escaping the floodwaters, going on higher ground. Some of them are drowning, you know, in the water. But eventually, picture like a human being. And let's say a flood starts to come in this area. You're like, wow, that's bigger flood than I've ever seen before. In fact, they hadn't seen floods, so the water's coming in, they're shocked. You know, yeah, Noah said there was a flood coming, but they didn't believe him, but now here comes this water, and they might be thinking, you know, maybe he was right, but that's fine, we'll just go over here, some higher ground. They go over there, but the water keeps coming. It's like, wow, this is really a big flood, we gotta go to the next hill. The water keeps coming. The next hill, eventually they get to the highest hill in their area, the water keeps coming. So now they literally start climbing trees. And they get as high as they possibly can. The water keeps coming. There's nowhere else to go. They drown. Their bodies decompose. Completely gone. No remains of them whatsoever. Some of them along the way get buried rapidly in local areas. You've got some sediments being buried very rapidly, burying a few people, a few mice or whatever. Those are the ones we dig up now that have become fossilized. But most of those creatures were able to escape the rising waters, but eventually floated and decomposed, and they're just gone. So it's really rare we find vertebrate fossils. Most of it's invertebrate sea creatures. The bulk of the rest are like plant life. And then the tiny, tiny smidgen after that are a few vertebrates here and there. So there's a lot in geology that defends the worldwide flood. I'll close with this. We know for a fact there are many layers in the earth. We see them all over. You go to the Grand Canyon, you see that's the best place to see them exposed there. But we do have canyons all over the planet. There's probably about 300 canyons. Some of them are bigger than the Grand Canyon. They're not as popular, a little harder to get to, they don't look as nice. But yeah, there are canyons all over the planet. So we know that's a fact. How they got there, how those layers got there and the canyons got there, we weren't there to see it. Christians were not there to see that happen. The atheists were not there to see that happen. The Bible gives us a great framework to properly understand why are we seeing all these layers with all these fossils in them. The worldwide flood. If there was really a worldwide flood, we should see sedimentary layers laid down all over the planet filled with fossils. And that's what we see. Sedimentary layers laid down by water filled with billions and billions of fossils. Secular scientists have a hard time explaining that because the order of that fossil record does not support slow, gradual evolution. It supports where were creatures living when the flood came. So I'll cut myself off with that, and I'll close my portion with a just short word of prayer. It's fascinating stuff. I hope overall that you were encouraged by this, not to memorize the facts to go out and win an argument with someone, but to be encouraged that you really can trust everything God says in the creation account, which was written as literal Hebrew historical narrative. It actually happened. You can trust that it really did, and science backs it up. And the flood was written as an actual event, and there's evidence for that. So I want you to be confident in trusting Scripture, not to win arguments, but to be confident so that when you're out sharing the gospel message, you know that you can trust all of God's word. So let me close in a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we just thank you for this time we've had to take a look at your word and the intricacies of DNA. It's fascinating what you did to create life, but we know as fascinating as that is, it pales in comparison to how much you care about us and who we are. You tell us we're the apple of your eye, and we thank you for that, and we thank you ultimately for the sacrifice you made, sending your son to die on a cross, because we, as your creation said, we don't want you. We think we know better than you. We're going to go our own way. And you could have just smashed us and started over, but you said, no, I got a plan. I'm going to send my own son to die on the cross to pay for the sins of the world. And thank you so much that you've given us this free gift. We don't have to work hard to try to be good enough. You told us we could never be good enough to meet your standard. That's why you sent Jesus, who is the perfect standard, to pay the price for us. And all we have to do is accept that as a free gift, ask for forgiveness, and could spend eternity with you. We just thank you for that and pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.